Well, thank you, everyone, for coming. I'm Stephanie Flanders. I'm the economics editor of Newsnight. I will happily not be doing much of the work this evening. I'll be listening to the panel that we have discussing work-life balance, management practices, and productivity. I have to say, being now 5 months pregnant, I've got much more interested in work-life balance over the last few months. I really hope that we can solve a lot of the problems that I know a lot of people have when they start trying to make that shift. Although I have a feeling if we actually got it right, it would be called life-work balance, but that's just me. The first speaker has actually been one of the few senior members of McKinsey to agree to work with Newsnight in the work that he's done on productivity and why the UK has continued to have a large gap with countries such as America and is only slowly catching up with other countries. As he will explain, that's what's led him into this research, but he's going to kick off with the origins, how we got to this piece of joint work, and then we'll have other speakers talking about the detail. So John Dowdy, who is the director of McKinsey and now the expert on UK and other countries' productivity. I'll ask you to speak first.
Thank you. That's very kind of you, Stephanie. Thank you. I remember that Newsnight episode. I really enjoyed the way it came out. Well done. And I was a bit disappointed with another part of your introduction, though, where you said I'd be doing all the work and you wouldn't. Actually, John Van Rienen is going to do all of the work. I'm just going to get us going, and I'd like to get us going by telling you what time Professor John Van Rienen prepared his material for today. It was at 2:30 in the morning, so I've been watching his email traffic, and I'm afraid if there's anyone who should be an expert on work-life balance, of course it's John. What I'd like to do is just get us going. And I think of the three items in the title: work-life balance, management practice, and productivity. These are strange bedfellows indeed. I think people have struggled for a long time to understand how they really fit together. I mean, do they work with each other or against each other? It's since the days of Frederick Winslow Taylor. Do you remember him? He walked around with, I couldn't even find an old one, but he walked around with one of these. Stopwatch, timing people as they were doing their work. Ever since then, people have been enthralled with what they called management science, the science of management. And Frederick Winslow Taylor started with metal cutting, but he quickly moved on to coal shoveling. And what he did is he watched workers while they were shoveling coal and timed them and observed how people with different shape shovels were able to shovel different types of coal at different speeds. So it turns out that there's one type of shovel that's much better for shoveling the so-called rice coal, and there's another type of shovel that's better for shoveling chunk coal. And he went through and scientifically developed this way of figuring out how people could shovel more coal. Now, it was Bethlehem Steelworks was his main area of study. And he reduced the number of coal shovelers at Bethlehem from 400 to 130 with that. Productivity, yes. Work-life balance, no. The invention of management science. He was not without his detractors. Now, Frederick Winslow Taylor wrote his book for which he's now famous in 1909. In 1910 and 1911, the U.S. House of Representatives had lengthy discussions about his findings. This new science, management science. And you know what they decided? They passed a law which banned the use of the stopwatch in factories, which stayed in place until 1949. I just bought mine today, so you can tell that it's not a big tool at McKinsey these days. In fact, I've got a spare now if anybody wants to come look at it after the presentation. But I think ever since then, there's been a tension, an inherent tension between these things. You know, even the use of the word science in management science, and when you compare that to productivity and work-life balance. Now, I'd like to take you back, not quite to 1909, in our study of these things. And it really didn't start with work-life balance. What it started with was how to understand the link between management practice and productivity. Now, you can say, gee, you must have a lot of spare time, because we all know that a well-managed firm is a productive one. So what a waste of time that is to try and prove it. And indeed, I think we all inherently feel it's true. A well-managed business is a productive business. I think you'd say, well, that's obvious, isn't it? And we also know how to measure productivity. Actually, you can debate how to measure productivity a lot. It can be value added per employee or value added per employee hour. You can play around with it quite a bit. But I don't think any of us really know how to measure management. And yet, I've been in a whole lot of plants, and I'll tell you that you can tell the good ones from the bad ones within about 5 minutes. You can walk in there, and there's something you can see and feel about the place. And we were trying to figure out just what is it? If you can walk in and tell, shouldn't it be possible to measure this? Now, before we started tonight, they were asking me, was I surprised by what we found? And I said, yes, no, no, yes, and no. And I think that because we found a lot of things along the way. The first thing that we looked for is to say, can you measure management practice? And the answer, off of our first look at just a relatively small sample of UK manufacturers, was yes. We managed to measure a set of things that allowed us to create a score for the effectiveness of management in that plant, which was incredibly well correlated with the productivity of the plant. So we were able to say, this thing that's management, can we measure it? Now, I thought that different well-managed plants would be good at different things. Some of them would be great at attracting and retaining people, for example, or another one would be great at laying out the shop floor. But what we learned is that the good plants were really good at everything, whereas the bad ones were bad at everything. Now, there's a bit of variation in that, as you'd expect, but what we'd captured is this thing called management, and that the best managed companies found the ways to do all of the things that really worked. And that was the first bit. We said, this is absolutely fascinating, but is it just true for the UK? So we went to the US, to France, to Germany, and collected data for those countries and said, is it telling us the same story? Or is this just a story that works in the more classic Anglo-Saxon environments? No, it appeared to be true for the continent as well, that our findings were really very, very similar. There were differences in terms of which levers people pulled, but this thing called management, you could measure it and link it to productivity in all of those places. But then we said, this is fascinating, but what about ICT? What happens when you put information technology into a business? Does that itself drive productivity up? What role does it really play? And, well, I guess that's a story for another evening. That's in and of itself a very interesting piece. But then one of the bits that started to come out was skills. Now, there's a lot of talk about skills at multiple levels, remedial skills all the way through to managerial skills. And it began to appear as one of the major descriptors of the differences we were seeing between countries, that we could describe away a big part of the difference in productivity by the difference in skills. And we said, let's really get into this thing. Let's get the human resource measures so we can take the same statistical rigor to our evaluation that we have of productivity and management practice and do it for work-life balance. So we collected all kinds of data about hours worked, about flexibility in the workplace, attracting women into a business, and we set out to analyze what was the real contribution that made. Work-life balance, is it an essential ingredient of productivity or an unwelcome distraction? That, my friends, is what Professor John Van Rieten will tell you next, so I hope you enjoy it. And John, I am going to be timing you.
Yeah, John's very much going to go over the answers produced by this report to the questions that they pose were the ones that we all want the answer to. Is it true that there's this, the two ways of looking at it, either work-life balance is something which is good for everyone, is a win-win situation, or this modern life of ours is just a one-off experiment because we've not been able to show that it can reproduce itself and that people can happily reproduce themselves and have a successful time at work. So we get the answer now.
Thank you, Stephanie. So the title is Work-Life Balance, Management Practice and Productivity, and as usual with the other speakers, I can say that the real people who have done the work here are actually sitting in front of me in the audience, Nick Bloom and Toby Kretschmer, also from the CEP, so that's a good excuse for blaming other people for things that you don't like in the paper you read. I should also thank very much the Anglo-German Foundation, the ESRC and AIM who have helped fund this research. So let me just tell you, why did we get interested in this? Well, and as a labour economist, when I started off working in economics and doing research, the real aim of the game was to try and understand unemployment and inequality. And those things are still important, but now unemployment has fallen to such historical low levels in this country. The issue has moved much more on to thinking about the quality of jobs rather than just the quantity of jobs. And the whole agenda around work-life balance has really started to go back, put the question back for economists, what actually happens at the place of work rather than just whether you have a job or not. And of course, that's linked very much to the very fast and sustained increases of female participation in the labour market that we've seen, which has obviously focused people's attention on how to balance the pressures of family life and work life. The other kind of the grander type of backdrop to all of this is, in some sense, the battle of ideas of what happens in Europe. So, two factors contribute to this. First of all, the fact that over the last 10 years, as Stephanie mentioned, there has been this kind of dramatic improvement in productivity in the US, which hasn't been matched in Europe. Also, more recently, we've seen that the European Constitution has been rejected by France. And this has really led to this kind of big discussion being reignited over which direction Europe should go in. So there's one group of thinking which I've rather unfairly, I think, labelled the kind of Chirac theory after the French president, who has criticised the kind of move towards what you might call a wild or savage neoliberalism, the kind of emphasis on very pro-market reforms, increasing competition through factors of globalization, but also through policy reforms such as prioritization and liberalization. And the argument is that although this may well increase productivity in Europe up towards American levels, it makes workers miserable. So working long hours under huge amounts of pressure, these kind of changes that we're seeing need to be resisted and reformed. So that's the view that there's very much a kind of trade-off between work-life balance and productivity. On the other hand, there's a lot more of an optimistic view, maybe epitomised more by the Prime Minister here, which you might call the kind of win-win view, that in fact improving work-life balance can increase productivity. So by improving morale at work or by helping the kind of retention and the recruitment of talented people in the workforce, better quality female managers, this can actually increase our productivity. And competition, the kind of marketplace, it's ambiguous over what the effects are, but you can imagine states of the world where having very competitive markets actually increases the war for talents and can actually mean that this can actually foster better work-life balance. But in any case, the view is that there's actually a positive impact of work-life balance on productivity. So the work which we've done, as John Daddy talks a bit about, the work that we've done in this research program at the CEP and with McKinsey and other people has really been looking at the kind of causes and consequences of management practices. So to what extent do management practices really increase productivity, and what are the things which cause variation in management practices and productivity, both between countries, why is rent of low productivity, and also within countries, why do you see this huge variation? So to tackle that, we collected, we've used this new innovative survey tool to collect data on almost 750 firms across 4 countries, where we've collected very detailed information on management, work-life balance, and productivity. And I'll talk a bit about what we've done and what we found in a second. But let me just give you what you might crudely call a model. Economists love models to think about things. So you might think about these two broad models, the kind of Chirac view versus the win-win view, as having predictions for what we should see between the correlation of work-life balance and three other factors. So think about good management, kind of Anglo-Saxon management practices which stimulate productivity, competition, and productivity itself. So how might work-life balance be correlated with those? Well, on the Chirac theory, it's pretty clear predictions. So tough product market competition means that you have worse work-life balance, negative correlation. You should see these kind of management practices, these tough management, Anglo-Saxon management practices being negatively correlated with work-life balance. And also productivity. If productivity is being driven up by making people work very hard, there's a trade-off between work-life balance and productivity. So again, there should be this negative correlation. So these are things that we can look at in the data. The more optimistic theory has different predictions. So the optimistic theory says that, you know, good management and work-life balance go together, should be a positive correlation. Ambiguous over competition may be positive, and you should actually see a positive effect of work-life balance and productivity. And this lies behind a lot of the government's policies to kind of improve work-life balance. There's a kind of view implicit in that, that, you know, employers are making mistakes. If only they were more enlightened and actually introduced better work-life balance policies, this could actually increase productivity. So there should be a positive correlation. Those are the questions, and what do we find? Well, in case sometimes happens I don't get to the end of the talk in time, and John's timing me very hard on this, let me cut to the chase and tell me what we find, very briefly. So we find three things. One, we find that well-managed firms do typically have better work-life balance. Secondly, we find that tougher product market competition, although it fosters better management, does not seem to harm work-life balance. So tough competition doesn't seem to systematically make people miserable on average. In fact, it seems broadly neutral. Thirdly, we find that improved work-life balance does not have a significant association with productivity. It neither seems to go up with productivity or go down with productivity. It's broadly neutral. That's important after we've controlled for management quality. So what I'm going to try and show you is that I think that the correlation that you see, and you do see a correlation, that better managed firms, so more productive firms have better work-life balance. Those are both reflecting the fact that the highly productive firms and the firms with better work-life balance tend to have better management practices overall. So in some sense, the pure correlation might be spurious. So what does that mean in terms of implications? So broadly speaking, we reject the kind of anti-globalization, kind of Chirac theory that work-life balance inevitably deteriorates under globalization. But we also don't find strong evidence that's win-win view, that it's a kind of it's a free lunch. In fact, we find that we have this kind of what we call the hybrid view, that work-life balance is, you know, effectively a choice for firms and really can be combined with high or low productivity. So let me tell you how we get there. So first of all, let me talk a bit about the data. So if you look at the handout that all of you should have on your seats, we'll go into a lot of detail on this. It's basically a one-hour telephone interview with the plant managers and the human resource managers in about 750 firms, 150 each in UK, France, and Germany, and 300 in the US. We have two different measures of work-life balance. The first work-life balance is extremely simple. So we basically try and get from the HR managers, relative to other companies in your industry, how much does your company emphasize work-life balance? So much less, slightly less, the same, slightly more, much more. Now, you might say this is very subjective, so we collected a lot more objective data on work-life balance, including all these factors such as how many hours people worked, how many holidays they took, whether they were allowed to work from home, switching between part-time and full-time, childcare flexibility, childcare subsidies, where they could share jobs. And we found that these factors, all these different factors of hours of work and so on, were correlated very strongly in the way you'd expect with this summary measure of work-life balance. So, for example, in firms where people had to work very long hours, work-life balance was very poor, as you'd expect. And in places where you had better childcare subsidies, you tended to see a positive answer to this work-life balance question. So though it's a crude summary measure, we think it's actually capturing at least something which is going on in the workplace in terms of work-life balance. The second thing that we got, and this is what John Dowdy talked about, was this overall measure of kind of good management practices. So we spend a long time trying to develop what we thought were robust measures here. So one of the ways that we try to get at this was through what might be called a double-blind technique. So the managers who were being interviewed didn't know that they were being scored across this range of practices. I mean, there's a lot of evidence in the psychological literature. If you know you're being scored, you're going to give the answers that people expect. So the way that the survey was structured was one where the managers were being interviewed. They didn't know that they were being scored on a particular scanning grid. And the interviewers themselves knew nothing about the company. They didn't know whether the company was highly productive or whether it was highly profitable or anything at all. So this double-blind technique was a way of trying to, we think a relatively good way of trying to get accurate information about management practices. We did multiple interviews in the same firm, and we did a variety of other things. There's 18 different dimensions of management we looked at, and you know, they're all out in the paper, so I'm just going to briefly talk about some of them. So one section was on kind of shop floor operations, how you deal with problems on the shop floor and the production line, lean manufacturing, just in time, and so on, very basic things. There's a selection of questions on monitoring, how well you track and review and evaluate performance. Questions on targets, whether these are open and transparent, whether it's easy to get them or they're genuinely stretching, how interconnected are they. And a whole lot of questions on incentives. So how you promote people. Do you promote them purely based on tenure, or do you actually, as we think you should do, take into account people's performance? When you reward them, do you actually take into account how hard they've worked, how well they've performed? How do you deal with things go wrong in the workplace? Do you do nothing, or do you actually try and fix, or at the end of the day, having to fire people and so on? So we had a whole range of these different questions. It turns out, as John mentioned, that although there are some variations, there's a very strong one factor of good management. You know, firms tend to be good or bad at all of these. And in some of the results I'm going to show you, we just simply take the average across all of these questions. And you know, as you'd expect, and well, it's good to confirm this, these were very highly correlated with productivity. And finally, we actually got a whole, you know, objective measures from the company accounts of productivity, so you know, measures of output per unit of input, sales per unit of capital, employment, measures of gender composition, hours, skills, and so on. The usual kind of things that you want to measure to try and get an idea about the firm performance. How much output does it get per unit of input? Okay, and I should mention that the things we're reporting here are kind of correlations in the data, controlling for many things. We haven't got a perfect natural experiment that we'd like where we randomly assign people into one category or another as we would if we were natural scientists, but I think the correlations that we're going to report are very robust and they're actually quite revealing. But you know, the caveat here is these are not directly causal relationships. Okay, so what do we find? First result, how does work-life balance correlate with good management? Turns out, if you look at Table 3 in the paper, the correlation is very strong. Many ways to cut this. Here's one way to cut it. So just on the horizontal axis, we just have this measure of work-life balance, whether it's from very low to very high. On the vertical axis is the average management quality. And you can see very clearly from this graph that where management quality is very high, as measured by these average of these different factors, you tend to get much better work-life balance. There's a very clear and strong relationship in the data. Now, that's true even when you start controlling for many other factors, which also are important. So it also turns out, for example, large firms tend to have better work-life balance than small firms. And that's kind of interesting, because large firms, these globalized firms that you might think are actually pushing workers to work harder, turns out that work-life balance is actually better in these larger firms. It tends to be better also in firms where you see more highly educated workers. Maybe that's because the fight for talent is stronger there. And interestingly, it's also the case in firms where you have a higher proportion of female managers, you also tend to see higher work-life balance. There could be many reasons for that. One might be where you have more female managers, there's more political power to women in the firm to try and improve the work-life balance policies in the company. On the other hand, it might be that companies which have better work-life balance actually attract more women and retain more women in senior positions. But whatever the case, you know, this correlation, which some other studies have also found, came out very clearly in our study. So that's our kind of the headline thing from the first result is that work-life balance and management practice overall are very highly correlated. Second result, competition. So it is the case that tougher competition destroys people's lives, makes them miserable. Well, tougher product market competition certainly seems to increase managerial quality, and that came out from our previous study. However, it doesn't seem to have a negative effect on work-life balance. So you can show this in many ways. Here's one way. We have three different measures of competition. One is kind of trade openness. One is kind of the degree of profitability. If you look at just the one in the middle, the number of competitors, very crude but straightforward measure, and more competitors you have, the more competition you have, you can see that the correlation, the size of this bar, is the kind of t-statistic, which is basically showing you the strength of the correlation, is very highly significant. Significant at 1% level, so this relationship only would happen by chance in less than 1 in 100 cases. So it suggests that tougher product market competition certainly seems to increase the average level of the quality of management, maybe through driving out the weak firms, maybe through increasing incentives to managers to work better. However, when you correlate that with work-life balance, there's basically no correlation. So it's not the case that having more competitors, if you actually, the number of competitors thing is positive, but it's so small you can't even see it on the screen. So in other words, there's no association really with tougher competition on reducing the work-life balance of people's place at work. So that's the second kind of interesting result. And we weren't expecting to necessarily to find either of these results, but it certainly came out very strongly from the data. Okay, this is the only table of econometric results I'm going to show you this evening, but I can't resist it, of course. Being a pointy-head econometrician, we've got to put up some tables of results. So what do these mean? Well, this comes from a kind of equation where we basically correlated the productivity of firms with the work-life balance. So the first column says, okay, if you increase work-life balance by 1 point in this kind of scale, on average, this is associated with an increase of productivity of about 3%. So that looks like what many other people have seen. You look around you, and the more productive firms have better work-life balance. However, the second column then starts to add in some extra controls. So we start controlling for skills, we start controlling for the size of the firm. Then you see the correlation starts to fall. And then the final column, column three, we include this average management score, the score of good management quality. And once you control for that, there's basically no relationship at all between work-life balance and productivity. So what does this mean? It basically means that, and if you interpreted this literally, it means that what's happening amongst firms is that there's well-managed firms and badly managed firms out there. And the well-managed firms tend to have higher productivity and also tend to have better work-life balance practices. And that's really what you're seeing in the data. It doesn't appear to be work-life balance per se, but rather a reflection of better management as a whole in the firm. So that's basically what we seem to find in the data. So what does all this mean? So let me go back to the kind of matrix of the Chirac theory versus the win-win theory. So what have we found? So in terms of management, we found this positive correlation. So that looks like that's kind of consistent with the optimistic theory. Well-managed firms tend to have better work-life balance. On the competition theory, we find basically zero. So we certainly don't find the kind of Chirac anti-globalization view that competition is terrible for work-life balance. However, neither do we find, and this is the productivity result, that better work-life balance increases productivity. It doesn't reduce productivity, as you might think of the Chirac view, but neither does it increase productivity. So the conclusion is that basically, both of these extreme views, if you like, these polar views, don't receive support from the data. What we really find is more of a hybrid type of view, where work-life balance is actually a genuine choice for firms. It can be combined with both high productivity and low productivity. It tends to be a feature of well-managed firms, but it doesn't necessarily mean that it's going to be something which is going to increase your productivity. So in terms of the policy, if I was to say, what are the main policy findings from this? Number one would be to say that in terms of the overall reform agenda of increasing competition, such as in the Services Directive in Europe, this is likely, we think, as many people have thought, to be good for productivity and overall management. It won't necessarily be bad for work-life balance. There's no necessary fall in the quality of people's workplace or work intensity from increased competition. So I think that in that sense, it doesn't support the anti-globalization perspective. Work-life balance may well be desirable in themselves. Certainly workers like it. And we can argue about whether we should have more or less of that. Companies have to come to a decision about that. But we shouldn't think that it's kind of manna from heaven, that it's somehow companies are making huge mistakes by not, on average, having better work-life balance policies, because on average there isn't this kind of super increase, a super boost of productivity once you control for management, in our view. So I think this, you know, the bottom line on this is that, you know, we have, certainly this doesn't give, I mean, what one view that some people have expressed on this is to say, well, doesn't this give carte blanche to any government to increase work-life balance? It doesn't hurt productivity, so why don't we just increase the regulation of work-life balance? Have to be very careful about that. There's cost to doing that. And, you know, although we've looked at productivity, we haven't looked at the profits. These things may have impacts on profits, which could possibly be bad for firms and increase exit of firms. So we have to be careful in weighing those up. But overall, those are the results, and I look forward to comments from my colleagues of what you think. Thank you.
Thanks, John. Well, we're now going to have comments from a couple of people who are involved in different sides of different aspects of this debate. First, Sarah Jackson. I'm tempted to call Sarah Jackson Ms. Work-Life Balance because she's a very well-known commentator on these issues. She's as the CEO of what's now known as the Work-Life Balance charity Working Families. She speaks often on these issues, and she has also been a judge on the Employer of the Year Awards. But she also embodies work-life balance because when she joined Parents at Work, which was one of the original organisations that this new one is now part of, she was in a job split, then a job sharing CEO, and she's now the sole CEO but works part-time. Sarah Jackson.
Well, thank you, Stephanie. And yes, Ms. Work-Life Balance. Ms., I've been promoting the win-win agenda for the last goodness knows how many years. And I must say, when I talk to anyone who runs their own business, particularly if they're working in a highly pressurised field like perhaps finance or the law, and I say, hey, you know, you can get the sensible work-life balance and, you know, it's not in conflict with successful management, they suck their teeth. I don't think it's going to work for us, they say. And essentially, I think we're going to struggle to convince managers and their organisations that work-life balance employment policies are more than a nice to have. It does remain an add-on, even for those organisations who have invested heaps in it. Basically, the cuts come when the shareholders want to see the results. As an example, Centrica have just done exactly that. After much investment in a company-wide flexible working initiative called WorkWise, they've just made big cuts in all their central functions, including all the people who developed WorkWise and were to move it forward. So I think in getting business or the world of work, if you like, to take work-life balance seriously, I think we're fighting two very deep-rooted assumptions, which is why we've been working so hard to find evidence to support the win-win scenario. So thanks, John. The first belief we've got to counter is that work-life balance means not committed. It's a girly sort of thing. Classically, children's pictures on your desk at work mean that you're a reliable, solid family man, unless you're a woman, in which case you're a half-hearted working mother whose team has to cover for her every time you pop off to look after the kids. And the second assumption is the primacy of the manager's right to manage. Work-life balance is seen to interfere with that. It means more regulation, or at the very least, it sets up a rather tiresome expectation that the manager will take time out of a busy day to accommodate the staff members' family problems. And I think that underneath both of those beliefs, there's a fundamental misconception that work-life balance is simply about less work, and that the word balance somehow implies that we're talking here a zero-sum game. And I think that this is a problem with terminology that we are going to have to tackle. Because I believe that what we're really talking about is creating the conditions which enable us all to put our energies where they're most required at different stages of our lives, or indeed at different stages of the working day, and not suffer detriment as a result. So he, on the one hand, should be able to become a plant manager without missing his children growing up, and she should be able to care for her disabled teenager without suffering poverty in her old age as a result. Now, we've been plugging away on the win-win business case for the better part of 20 years, because clearly to bring around about change in the way that employers organise work and treat their employees, we have to appeal not to their altruism, but to the bottom line. But I do think, and have always believed, that the business case, the win-win argument, is limited. The economics of it mean that for every organisation which is looking simply at cost benefits around, for example, recruitment and retention, there will come a point when the business case no longer stacks up, as we've just seen with Centrica, or, as demonstrated just before Christmas, when the CBI withdrew its support for the government's Work and Families Bill as bringing in too much costly regulation which it believes will damage business. The trade-off for the CBI is now too great. And that's why, for many of us working on work-life balance, the Holy Grail has become a demonstrable link between flexible working and work-life balance policies and increased productivity. So actually, I am quite encouraged by this LSE report, because it is very good to see the correlation between good management, good productivity, and good work-life balance practice. We found a similar picture when we carried out a YouGov survey of working parents last year. Now, what we were doing was qualitative research, but it tells basically the same story. The parents who felt most productive also reported that they had good managers, they enjoyed their work, and they were satisfied, generally, with their work-life balance. So for me, the conclusion that I'm beginning to reach is that perhaps it's not necessarily that work-life balance leads to increased productivity, but that work-life balance is very much an indicator of good management, and good management is certainly linked to effective and productive organisations. And I wonder now whether, in fact, we're going to reach a point where we understand that what we need for successful and productive workplaces is management based on adult-to-adult relationships within which flexibility and work-life balance are possible and are derived from a shared understanding of what the organisation is there to achieve, what the targets and the deliverables are, and how the role of each individual helps to achieve those. And what this does is it takes us into an area of thinking about job and work design, which does require greater skill on the part of managers, but which can deliver not just improved business or service outcomes for the organisation, but improved work-life balance for employees. And what's important here, I think, is that one of the key arguments against investing in work-life balance employment policies is the cost of doing so. But if you separate out the cost, the typical suite of work-life balance policies, you can put to one side those that have direct additional costs, so you might be looking at childcare subsidies, for example. What you'll be left with is what you find in most of the successful and flexible small and medium-sized businesses. You find flexible working arrangements and not a lot else. Now, the cost of getting flexible working right is essentially in management time and manager training, because managing flexible working does make greater demands on a manager than perhaps some of us have been prepared to admit. It's important because a problem that we hear about more and more frequently, and particularly I would say in large public sector organisations, is that flexible working seems to get itself into a position where it's seen as the individual employee's right. So team managers get stuck with totally inflexible, flexible working patterns that no longer meet the needs of the organisation. And case studies which were published last year by Professor Rona Rappaport in research that was funded by the Ford Foundation in the US tracked a similar pattern, where managers were letting employee flexibility take precedence over what the team was there to deliver. And the result that you get in those situations is that the concept of flexibility and the opportunities that it should give to all becomes devalued and mistrusted. But if investment in training managers to manage flexible working is understood as an investment in training them to be better managers, then I think we're all beginning to get back into that win-win position. And I think that also explains why it is that competition need not necessarily lead to reduced work-life balance for employees, because good managers responding to competition will use work-life balance policies as part of their arsenal for success. And this, for me, is really important, because that's when the business case becomes just one element of a much wider economic and social case in which we are able confidently to say that this work-life balance stuff is not just about organisations and their productivity, but about functioning families and about successful societies. Because where I think the Chirac model is correct is that the tendency of an organisation facing competition is to see itself in relation only to its competitors or its customers or its shareholders. It doesn't see itself in terms of the impact its employment policies have on the wider community, which is made up of its employees, their families, and their other networks. And the bad manager in the Chirac model responds to competition by trampling on employee rights in the pursuit of business success. Which brings us to regulation, public policy, and the position of working families. The initial driver for setting up this organisation or its heritage organisations 20 years ago was that work was indeed having a negative impact on families, and this continues to be demonstrable. And that's why current government plans to increase childcare, to extend the right to request flexible working to carers, to make paternity leave more generous for fathers, are all very important. And it's why employers are also going to have to think about their older employees and their work-life balance needs. Think about grandparents who are taking time to look after their grandchildren, employees who've got elder care responsibilities, or employees with adult dependents. And there's also the small matter of the pensions crisis and the likely need for many of us to work longer later in life. So, but not necessarily, I think, full-time and certainly not full-on when we're 75. The point is that today men and women work, but right now most of the caring is still carried out by women. We need to equalise domestic and workplace involvement for men and for women. And to do so, we do need regulation, because even good managers need a spur to do things differently. And that, I think, brings us back to the correlation between good management and higher levels of work-life balance. In many ways, for me, it almost doesn't matter which comes first. The important thing is to keep the link clear. Because although John says that firms have a genuine choice about whether they look at work-life balance or not, I think for us as a society, we do not have a genuine choice. Families need work-life balance, and fortunately, the good firm and the good management find work-life balance an advantage. So in conclusion, we need to challenge the belief that work-life balance and good business are incompatible. To do so, we do need more evidence of the complementarity of work-life balance and good management. And maybe, too, we need to change the language. As long as work-life balance means the mommy track and means not committed and red tape, we have limited chances for change, which for me means continuing problems for individuals and families and continuing lost opportunities for employers.
The last speaker is Julie Meller, who's currently at Price Waterhouse as a partner leading the change management practice for the public sector, but probably best known to all of you as chairman of the Equal Opportunities Commission, which she was for the last 6 years. I think she's going to give another sort of, you know, partially dissenting view of the research, and particularly looking at the equality issues and the sort of more micro-level benefits of work-life balance.
Indeed, you're right to say it's more of the same, in that the horrible thing about following Sarah is we agree about everything and make a lot of the same points. She said everything. So I will make some of the same points, but illustrated by some of the data from Equal Opportunities Commission research and my own private sector and now PwC experience. I think I would agree with the argument made at the beginning, or in press coverage, I can't remember which it was, that it's specious to argue that top-performing companies who are good at work-life balance and equality generally prove any kind of causal link. And I'm comfortable with the data presented this evening in terms of competition and globalisation being consistent with people being able to reconcile their work and family life. And I'd agree that work-life balance can be linked to either low or high productivity, and I would agree that work-life balance is often associated with good management. In fact, equality generally is. Before I was chair of the Equal Opportunities Commission, I was also a commissioner for the Commission for Racial Equality, representing the CBI, in fact. And one of the things that struck me in both organisations, where we had to do formal investigations into organisations that had really appalling problems, whether it was horrendous sexual harassment or victimisation of ethnic minority staff or discrimination of some other form, what we found in every organisation was that that appalling treatment of particular groups of staff was actually part of a much bigger pattern of appalling management generally. But what I don't think it means is that we knock out actually what I don't call the win-win. I call it the win-win-win, and this is to make a point that Sarah made, which is that this is about winning for business, winning for individuals, and actually winning for children and our elderly parents and disabled people that we look after. So I think it's about all three. And so the points that I wanted to make, really using some of the EOC research, were In terms of the good quality management, being able to have a retention rate that works for its business, and I recognise it's different in different businesses. You know, a higher turnover is healthy in some sectors. Then I think while I understand the kind of general macroeconomic case that's being made, I think we can see examples of where for an individually probably well-managed firm already, the further benefits that they have found by introducing work-life balance policies. So, for example, in Britain, 38% of women and 10% of men end up giving up a job or not being able to take up a job because of their care responsibilities at some stage during their working life. And just to give a couple of examples of where firms have managed to shift that in their own organisation, in PwC in the late 90s, 40% of women taking maternity leave didn't return from that leave, and now we're up to, no, sorry, only 40% returned, and now we're up to 92% return. HSBC found when it introduced flexible working arrangements that they trebled the return rate from maternity leave. In terms of motivation impacting upon retention, then at PwC again in the late 90s, 40%, only 40%, were satisfied with the balance they got between work and other things they wanted to do with their lives. And that's now, it's not good enough yet, but it's up to 70%, so it's nearly doubled in about 8 years. So there's those retention issues. And then I think, again, for individual firms that are already well managed, they've been able to measure for themselves increases, direct increases in productivity. So the RAC, for example, found that when it introduced annualised hours, it had a measurable, in its terms, 8% increase in productivity. And then I think there are, again, the arguments that Sarah was making, but wider economic arguments, not just about the level of individual firm, but about UK PLC. And one is that in Britain we have particular areas where we've got significant skill shortages, like construction, plumbing, information technology, engineering. And you just listen to those labels. Are there many women working in those areas? The vast majority of Britain's 7 million people who work part-time, and nearly all of those are women, work in caring, cleaning, catering, clerical and cashiering, the five C's as we know them. And why do they work in those horrendously low-paid sectors? Because they can work part-time, and that's how they reconcile things. But half of people who work part-time in Britain, that's 3.5 million people, say that they worked in higher level jobs using more of their qualifications and experience when they worked full-time than now they're working part-time. So that is a huge underutilization of their skills in our economy. And employers are saying if they could find ways of enabling more women to work in those non-traditional areas like construction, plumbing, IT and engineering, then they think it would help Britain crack its skill shortages. So there are some market inefficiencies here that are affecting UK performance as a whole. And then I think there's the argument that Sarah was making about the kind of wider society benefits. And I would just add some data to that, which are about us as taxpayers, in that if I can't remember which, it's the Office of National Statistics, I think, did a household survey that costed the care work, not household chores, but actual care work we do in our homes, looking after other people. And if you add together roughly the care work, looking after children and looking after others, if it had to be paid for, it would cost £277 billion, which is a fifth of GDP if it counted. And if 10% of us stopped looking after our elderly relatives, those who are currently doing it, it would require a 33% increase in the budget for social care in Britain. So there are direct consequences for our society, both in terms of quality of care and what people want for their elderly parents, and what we pay as taxpayers. And then the last point really is one around, again, a kind of wider social point about equality and choice, because I know that what parents in Britain say today is that what they want more than anything is some choice about how they share responsibilities for earning the family income and responsibilities for looking after their kids or elderly parents or other relatives needing care. And we've seen this silent but dramatic social revolution where dads are now doing a third of the parental childcare in Britain, and that's an 800% increase on what it was just 30 years ago. So that that desire to choose is based on a practical social revolution. It's not just dreaming that they would like to choose. And my hunch is that the CBI withdrawal from supporting new parental leave arrangements are partly because of proposals to provide more paternity leave in a way that it means a higher proportion of the workforce are going to be eligible for leave. And the Treasury decided it wasn't going to offer the option of administering the pay arrangements for people on leave. And I think that CBI withdrawal is partly because business is actually refusing to catch up with these changes in the reality of family life in Britain. And that will affect our economy long term. So my conclusion is the reality is all of us at some point in our life have significant, at some point in our working life have significant care responsibilities. And if the workplace isn't transformed, labour market inefficiencies will get worse, not better. And therefore, I think we'll be reaching the position where not just that work-life balance is linked to good management, but that actually supporting families will be a prerequisite of good management in the 21st century.
Thanks, Julie. I think we've moved on from it maybe not being a win-win, but certainly long-term being a lose-lose. I don't know whether that's the response from that. Just before we open up the discussion, I know that the two other authors of the report were going to come up to join, Toby Kretschmer and Nick Bloom. Are they in there?
In case we get a really hard question.
Yeah. Well, I might put them on the spot right now so they get their 2 minutes. We'll probably do about 50 minutes or so with Q&A. I'll kick off with a question. I don't know whether either of you want to take this on. Obviously, I'm coming at it partly wanting to know the policy implications of all of this. John sort of snuck some in at the end of his conclusions, some of which didn't seem to directly follow from the results. I'm not sure whether they just the presumption of any economist is always that there were likely to be costs on firms of government-imposed work-life balance, I suspect. I'm not sure that's in the findings, but I might be wrong. One implication you could draw from this is that there's no harm to be done setting up government incentives. If it really is a wash for firms economically to have good work-life balance, then that might be a reason, given that there might be social benefits of having good work-life balance practices. There's no reason why government shouldn't intervene. I guess the argument against that is this problem of imposing regulation or imposing economic costs. Yeah.
So there's kind of a couple of clear policy things that come out of this. The first is, in terms of imposing regulation, think of things like statutory maternity and paternity leave. While it may not have an effect on productivity, it could potentially have quite a big effect on profitability. And you can imagine if profits go down, in the long run, that's going to reduce jobs. So at the moment, there's a neutral trade-off. If the government introduces better work-life balance regulation, that's clearly good for work-life balance, but there's a bit of concern about long-run employment. The other thing that's interesting is in terms of competition. So people typically get concerned about high levels of competition because it's bad for employees. So what we've shown in other work, and other economists have shown, and you know, McKinsey have done a lot of work on this, is that competition is clearly very good for productivity. It's very good for management. So there's a clear win on this. But we don't find there's any negative effect on work-life balance. So competition per se looks to be a pretty positive thing to try and increase in terms of openness and more competition and globalization.
And on that sort of paternity leave issue that's come up, the government's proposals and the CBI opposition to it, I don't know whether one argument again for that would be that it's only levelling the playing field somewhat on the employment front between men and women. Do you think there would be risks of high costs on the basis of this evidence, or again, no cost either way?
Well, I mean, the way I think about it, I mean, I draw a distinction between a couple of things. So, I mean, certainly there's lots of arguments on the grounds of equity and wider
benefits to society for having, you know, work-life balance policies such as certainty. And those, you know, both Julie and Sarah pointed those out, and you know, we can discuss those. I mean, I'm very sympathetic to those, but there is a line of argument which also says, and which goes a bit beyond that, and says that not only are these things beneficial from an equity point of view, but they will be beneficial on average to firms in terms of improving their productivity. In other words, firms are actually making mistakes. They're not doing things which are in their own best interest. Now, some firms might be doing that, and some firms might not be doing that. But on average, it seems to me, at least in terms of the productivity, we don't see this, you know, extra cascading benefit effects, which some people, maybe it's the win-win-win-win group, some seem to be arguing for. Now, in answer to your question, Stephanie, on the cost thing, I mean, remember, we're just looking at productivity here. And, you know, as Nick said, there's this big difference between kind of productivity and profitability. So I mean, productivity is the first thing you want to look at, is the overall benefit to society. But from the firm's point of view, and, you know, also, you know, from the government's point of view, when you think about things, you know, there are costs. So, you know, doubling your capital stock is going to increase your productivity, but we wouldn't want a regulation that every firm should double the capital stock. So the cost thing at the end is just a kind of reminder to kind of say that, you know, you have to, it's not obvious that just because there's no cost in terms of productivity of work-life balance policies, that, you know, that this is therefore follows that we should be increasing our regulations. So in terms of certainty, I agree, you know, it sounds reasonable to make things there on the equity point of view, but on in terms of the efficiency point of view, I don't the arguments overwhelm.
Can I just pick up two thoughts about regulation? I just wanted to make sure people weren't thinking that employers were going to be expected to pay the statutory pay elements of any increases in parental leave. So in that sense, it wouldn't be impacting on productivity, because the government proposals would be that the statutory pay would be reimbursed by government.
But it's costly to administer, I think, was their point.
Yes, but that's a smaller cost than the cost of actually paying the wages. The other thing I think we have to look at is better regulation. I mean, we assume regulation means cost and is a bad thing, but one of the pieces of research we did at the Equal Opportunities Commission was about pregnancy discrimination, where something horrendous, I can't remember now, I haven't been there for 6 months, I haven't got all the facts and figures at my fingertips, but I think it was something like half of all pregnant women experienced some form of pregnancy discrimination. And actually, it was because the regulation was crap. And it didn't mean you needed to get tighter enforcement. It meant you needed to think through better how to make this work for both employee and employer. One of the challenges for employers was actually planning how long someone was going to be off, because people taking leave were only required to give something like 4 weeks' notice, which made it very difficult for employers to plan. So there are ways of regulating that can work better, rather than just saying, don't want regulation.
If we go through to questions, yes, in the back and the blue, yes. If you wait for if you just wait 1 second, just get the mic, and yeah, say roughly what you're
feeling. I'm Mandy Wright, and I'm from the local government employers. So I was quite interested in, A, that it was a lot about manufacturing and not about services, and obviously it was about the private sector, not the public sector. And I think there might be different implications there, because I think an awful lot of you link work-life balance with ways of making services more flexible, because most people want services offered at a wider range of times and places than they are. And if you can link that to what staff need and want, and they want different things at different times in their lives, it enables us to use the money we have better to provide a better quality service. We may not get paid for it. In fact, we probably don't get any reward for doing it better, other than government ratings. But I mean, we're in a different kind of situation from you. But it for us, it's a way about using your resources better. And we have tried quite hard, and indeed we've done some work with Joe Morrison, the unions, on it, on trying to get joint approaches to finding ways that you can identify how you want the service to be offered more flexibly, and trying to match that to the different ways people want to be flexible. And classically, for example, in one local authority, we found that half of the people interviewed wanted to work longer hours than they did, and the other half wanted to work shorter hours, but most of them were kind of in the wrong ones. And when you use that to cover a much longer and varying patterns of work, you can begin to get quite good matches, not always and everywhere, but many more than you think. And so I think that improves the quality of the service to the person out there, but it's not a profitability issue. But I think it is a productivity issue, because we found that we had lots of people at work at times when they weren't wanted to be there, and we weren't offering services at the time when people did want them, so they weren't getting the services they needed. You see what I mean? So that's a different kind of productivity. I just wondered, having said all that, if you are going to look at some of those other areas more widely and have tried to apply it outside of the manufacturing and private sector
John,
arena.
Do you want to? I suspect the answer is you have to solve all the horrific problems of doing public sector productivity.
Well, listen, it's a fascinating point, and I think first just a word on our plans going forward. You've correctly identified that the survey data you're looking at is from the manufacturing sector. That's absolutely the case. We're working right now to look at extending the survey. Firstly, into retail and health, I believe, are the two areas we're looking at, in addition to moving into additional countries. So we're certainly very aware of the fact that this is, you know, something that touches about one-fifth of the total economy, and we'd love to get into the, you know, into the public sector and into the service economy, because I think it would be fascinating to see whether some of these things hold up. Listening to what you said, though, I mean, one of the things I find fascinating about manufacturing is that I'll buy something not really worrying whether it was built at 4 a.m. on Tuesday or at midnight on Sunday. And the manufacturing sector certainly has the advantage that products can be produced at a different time than they're consumed. If I want to go to McDonald's, I really want to go there when I want to go there. So I don't know, I guess, whether your hypothesis is in fact going to hold up or not. It might well prove that flexibility in the service sector is even more important. It might end up to be the same, and it might be less important, but that's why we want to go and do it. So that's the plan, and I think we're probably going to start working that agenda this year.
I'm going to take a few at a time because there's lots of people. I know Robert back there. And then we'll go some of these.
Thanks. Is that on?
Yes.
I'm not going to the defense of Monsieur Chirac, but I'm fascinated by the productivity comparisons and its relation. I hope you'll do further research on this, because the truth of the matter is the French productivity rate is substantially more greater than it is in the United Kingdom. Mm-hmm. Somehow or another, you might say the French have got a win-win situation in manufacturing. If you turn to table B1, you see that there's an enormous amount of flexibility and dynamism in the French tables. Even in manufacturing, for example, there's much more switching from full-time to part-time work. There's more job sharing going on. And interesting enough, there's a substantial childcare subsidy. I assume that subsidy comes from the French state, not from French employers, but I'd like some clarification on that. But the overall picture suggests that the productivity in France, which is about 20% higher, Treasury figures suggest this is the case, despite the rhetoric, the reality is quite substantial. They got much better, on the basis of these figures here, much better work-life balance policies and higher productivity. Or am I misunderstanding the French data?
Okay, we'll just... I think that is probably true, but we better do some more questions. There's a woman at the back...
Dutch, I'm slightly amused we're having this conversation 35 years after the Dutch have proven that you can do it. Holland had all these policies that you mentioned here, you know, work-life balances, highly subsidized childcare, women, all women working, and yet the Dutch companies were at the forefront of competition internationally. Holland was one of the wealthiest economies in Europe, if not in the world, and yet they combined that with the welfare state, quality, sharing of the wealth. The evidence is that Scandinavian countries do too. Why are we having this conversation? 5 years later in Britain.
And up here, there's a gentleman in the front, and also this woman here.
There was a study by Gallup recently published in the Harvard Business Review looking at strong correlations between employee engagement and productivity. And surprisingly, perhaps, there were no questions in measuring employee engagement and good management practices on work-life balance. But there were questions that they ask employees that they see correlate to productivity, good customer satisfaction, a number of metrics. Some of these questions are, knows what is expected of me at work, someone cares about me, and maybe some of that work-life balance is covered in those questions. So my question would be, can we measure, in looking at employee engagement and also work-life balance, we want to give the choice to people to work more than maybe what regulations, policies would give. I mean, the 35, I come from France, 35-hour week is imposed, and a lot of us wish we could work more if we wanted to. So I think if we measure employee engagement and ask the question differently, maybe we could get to increasing people's productivity and still giving them the freedom to work as much as they want or as little as they want. If we define outcomes as well, with the question, knows what is expected of me at work, I guess if you define the outcome and let people define the steps themselves on how they get the work done, not necessarily want to do FaceTime, work 8 hours and still get the job done, or 6 hours, it's the flexibility we were talking about earlier. So I don't know if any of you have read that article, or what would your reaction be to asking the question differently?
Okay, we'll just have one more. So this gentleman in the front row up here, and then we'll get some responses and then we'll come back.
Thank you. Hartley Dean from the Department of Social Policy here at the LSE. I'm just beginning some research on the experiences of work-life balance in a low-income neighbourhood. And I'm particularly interested as to whether your data suggested that even though increased competition may not necessarily have harmed work-life balance overall, whether indeed it could drive a polarisation of experiences of work-life balance. Because certainly there's a certain amount of evidence that I'm aware of that suggests that firms with strong work-life balance policies may find that those are policies that are benefiting the head office rather than benefiting those at sort of operational or branch level. So it may well be enhancing retention following maternity of skilled, highly paid workers, for example, but are making no difference at all as far as the kind of women who stack the shelves in the supermarket in the middle of the night.
Hmm. Well, there's lots of things to respond to that. I don't know whether, John, whether you wanted, or one of your co-authors wanted to respond to the sort of France and Netherlands do have a win-win situation argument.
Okay, so I'll give you my tuppence halfpenny worth, if you like. So Robert's question on France is an interesting one, and he's absolutely correct that the output per hour in France is significantly higher than it is in the UK. Now, a lot of that is actually due to higher capital per hour in France than it is in the UK. So if you actually take that out and look at total factor productivity, you find, in fact, it's pretty similar between the UK and France. The interesting thing about the French case is, although a lot of Jacques Chirac will rail against globalisation, if you actually look what's happening in France, there's been huge waves of privatisation. There's been the opening up of the market because of the single market in Europe. We have a common trade policy. So in fact, the forces of competition in France have actually grown a lot stronger over time. One final consideration, I think the French productivity numbers are slightly flattered as well by the fact that they have very high unemployment rates and large proportions of people who aren't working. So I think the employment rate in Britain is something like 75%, whereas in France it's 62%. So for a large proportion of unskilled people not actually working, it's not surprising that you have a kind of batting average effect. Your productivity looks a bit higher. So that would be my kind of comments on France, and I know the Dutch case to a lesser extent, but I think there's also some of that going on there. I think one word on my colleague's point on social policy. I think that's a very interesting point you raise over whether some of these work-life balances policies are distributed unequally within the firm, And that's not something, I mean, Nick can correct me, that's not something we looked at directly yet, but I think that's something we should look at, because you know, there may well be this thing where, at the competitive point of view, you're struggling for talent of the best female managers, but you put a lot less emphasis on, say, the kind of people at the lower end of the workforce, and that could be something.
That's true of skills and training, isn't it? That it all tends to go to people who are already skilled and trained.
Absolutely. Yeah. So if you look at training, it tends to be complementary with high human capital. So
I wonder on that polarisation point. You just said something very intriguing, Sarah, when you were saying that sometimes the flexibility policies are too inflexible or they don't work for. I mean, are there any lessons on that that could also help in terms of distributing them more fairly across the company?
Well, I think the lesson is that managers need to learn how to plan and resource work. Is this, am I pointing in the right direction? Because I was thinking, very much our experience is that firms will focus their policies on top management, or it's where the war for talent, if you like, is not the plays against the wider UK-based social and economic case for work-life balance. It's not about equity, it's about let's invest in the people we really want to keep. And the people who we are helping on a day-to-day basis on our free legal helpline are the people who are really suffering the work-life imbalance in the UK, and they are those low-paid women who Julie was talking about earlier, who are coping with managers who really don't understand any of this. They just want somebody to be sitting at the desk or on the production line churning out whatever, and they are probably low-skilled, they're not being invested in any way, shape or form. And I think the frustration for us is that we do see examples of where it works extremely well, and I would use two public sector examples. In the Employer of the Year Awards that we've been running for years and years, recently, actually this was a Best Boss competition, we also have a competition where employees nominate their boss, and we had a charge nurse who was running a ward in a East Anglian hospital for very severely mentally ill people, lots of levels of violence, people queuing up not to work on that ward. And she adopted flexible working, she empowered her team, she engaged the team in managing the ward, and the levels of violence patient on patient and patient on staff dropped. And similarly, the Scottish Employer of the Year this year is the Scottish Legal Aid Board, a public sector organisation, who, when they looked at how they were organising their shift patterns, realised that their core working hours, because they were running classic public sector flexi time, involved people being in the office 2 till 4 in the afternoon when all the solicitors that they were there to serve were in court. It's why I think that John's report is so important, because it's saying this is about good management, and good management is about people thinking creatively, understanding the workplace and what they're there to do, and then looking at the whole breadth of the workforce that they have. And so it's about skills at all levels in that workforce.
Yeah. I was actually going to comment on polarisation. It's something, in a sense, we actually see. And it's reported a bit in the paper, which is, if you look at skills, these are very significantly correlated with work-life balance. So you see firms which have much higher skilled employees who are almost always better paid, they get treated better. Firms which are typically low-skilled get treated worse. And this goes very much with what Sarah was saying, for example, on our senses. One of the issues is, of course, if you're low-skilled, you're low-paid, you're working primarily to, you know, get money to pay the rent, to put food on the table, you typically care less potentially about work-life balance, or at least employees treat you badly in that sense. And as you move up the skill and pay barrier, they have to fight more on multiple fronts. And as Sarah's saying, it's important to try and move that down, the pay distribution, to try and ensure work-life balances across skill levels. But you know, we see clear evidence of polarisation.
Unless there's something, there's so many people who have questions, I feel like we should go back at least once more. Gentleman in the middle and the front, and then we'll go.
Thank you. Ken Turner, I was involved in private industry for many years, more recently been involved as an elected member in local government. The one universal problem which we've encountered in both fields, and which I think work-life balance was originally introduced to try and resolve, was the problem of absenteeism, particularly stress-related absenteeism, which... Now, if that is included in your productivity assessment, fine, but if it isn't, it certainly should be, because that is one of the major causes, particularly in these days of, to use the euphemism Professor used earlier, lean staffing for services.
That's not a euphemism at McKinsey. I think that's a way of life.
The second point is we've heard nothing about assessing the quality of the life part of the work-life balance. Now, in manufacturing, that can be compartmentalised fairly effectively. In the service industry, and certainly in local government, it's very difficult and the lines get blurred. And with the increasing intrusion of business into the home through mobile phones, through emails and so on, to what extent is that aspect being considered in terms of the quality of life? One final point on polarisation. Private medicine is probably one of the best techniques used in order to improve the work-life balance for senior people, but of course is not available to most of the lower paid people where stress is equally important. Thank you.
Now there's a lady, is she now just gone? She gave up waiting. There's a gentleman here with a beard. Just going to get the mic.
Hello, I'm Stephen McMahon. I research the older workforce at the University of Surrey. And I was really pleased that both Sarah and Julie mentioned the point about the work-life balance being at least as much an issue for people in the later stages of their working lives as for mid-career women. I think there is a problem that in most people's minds, when you talk about work-life balance, they think you mean maternity and childcare, and they don't think you mean the end of working life. Certainly our work suggests that if you ask older workers, people over 50 in the workforce, about work-life balance, they say they haven't got a problem. If you ask them about flexibility, they talk endlessly about flexibility. And I think what I wanted to say was that our work suggests that about 80% of the people over 50 in the workforce say they would like to work longer than they expect they're going to. And the reason they're going to work less long than they want to is precisely because of issues to do with flexibility, to do with part-time working, to do with variable hours, all those kind of questions. And we will not achieve our Lisbon targets of raising real retirement ages unless we do something about that problem. It is an intractable problem, it is difficult, but employers are picking it up. And I think it was really interesting that you're looking at health and retail, because our evidence suggests that health, retail and financial services are the three sectors where employers are doing serious things about flexible working, specifically in order to address the ageing workforce, or with a specific emphasis on the ageing workforce, because actually those are sectors where either the special skills of older people are more appropriate. Older people, for instance, advising on financial services to people coming up to retirement, pensions and those kind of things, but also the flexible hours, precisely the point that was being made about local governments, that older people actually are quite happy to work often hours that younger people are not prepared to work. You can deliver a better service. And I think that point about quality of service, which is a result of more flexible working, is a really important one to investigate.
Thank you. Two people at the front who've shown remarkable ability to hold their hands in the air for a really long time.
Thank you. I wanted to express a certain amount of disappointment. I'm a bit of a language freak myself, and I think words matter. And I came here wondering whether you were going to explain what work-life balance actually meant. And I think everybody has obfuscated. That probably suits the agendas of quite a lot of the people on the table. I notice that politicians need to make language difficult and obscure sometimes when they have agendas that might otherwise get derailed by scientific hard facts. One of the things that's nice about the LSE is that you come to see scientists, with a capital S, arguing with politicians and sparks fly. But sometimes you get scientists, I don't know whether the guys here think they have a small S or whether they actually claim the capital S, but nevertheless, I think they're also adept politicians, and as soon as you have scientists who double as politicians, then the language game is enjoined. People collude with the obfuscation. Work-life balance. First of all, the distinction between work and life. There's politics here too, of course. for men, a lot of men, and I'm going to tread on a few toes here and I apologize, and this is a generalization, it's not true, but nevertheless, historically speaking, men actually saw their life happening at work, and women tended not to. Until we settle that political divide, then the whole point, the idea that somehow we all have something to gain by striking the same work-life balance, is one that's going to hide a lot of political difficulties. I've got ex male colleagues whose life did not begin, as far as I could see, until they'd left home in the morning, and it kind of ended as soon as they got back. And they proudly boasted that they'd never had a day's illness in their life. If work-life balance, we got it right, then we would be working the same hours and everybody would be wanting to work the same hours as we used to work before we started talking about work-life balance. Work-life balance came in as a term precisely because everybody felt they were working too hard. If work-life balance doesn't mean working less, then I think we're deluding ourselves. But that was glossed over as well. I went working 4 days a week precisely because I felt 5 days a week was too much, and I had a short working week. I had a 36-hour week, and that was too much for me. I went to work a 30-hour week. It was glorious. I have to say that my experience was that I felt even less committed to the time I spent in the office for those 30 hours than I had when I was doing 36. I told my managers it would be the other way around. It wasn't. My question is, I suppose...
Yeah, we are running out of time.
Thank you. Yeah. If work-life balance is about workers' well-being, and I think it should be, and Chirac had anything to say at all, he was probably saying his concern that with a kind of free market American model, we were going to export unemployment across into Europe. It strikes me that in times of low unemployment, which everybody said were historical unemployment lows at the moment, times of low unemployment, good managers in competitive firms are going to have to bend over backwards to get every single manager's bum on the seat that they can, and work-life balance is going to go up. In times of high unemployment, surely the opposite would happen. I want to know whether we've got any plans to investigate the correlation between commitment to work-life balance and unemployment levels.
Okay, we're going to do two more. We have really gone over time against all my personal rules because there were so many questions, but if the last two could be very brief, I'd be grateful.
Right, Tom Batten, a student. My question was, I was hoping you could elaborate a little bit more on the correlation between management effectiveness and work-life balance and whether or not you saw it solely or principally as a recruitment tool and a retention mechanism. And the data would seem to have borne that out a little bit, given that you said that large businesses had a lot more work-life balance programs in place. It seems almost like an insurance mechanism. It's very difficult for a small business to put those programs in place, and the large businesses are fighting out for top management. And secondly, when it comes to the policy implications, I know you said the advice was not to put work-life balance or impose it from government because of the cost on firms. It seems like it would impact small firms more than large firms. But I'm also wondering if there's an impact on the individuals it's supposed to help, much like many people might argue that in the U.S. the ADA might have impacted a disabled individuals searching for work, and whether you see a cost to individuals with that.
Mm. There's a woman in the front.
Jo Morris from the TUC. The first thing that I feel can't be left unsaid, and it's a question, but also a statement. We work the longest hours in the EU15, and there is a complete double facing of the government and a lot of other people about talking about work-life balance while not doing anything about long hours. And what all the research shows is that many people are working very long hours while others are working shorter hours than they want. And so my question is how are you looking at that, the ability of employees to control the number of hours they work? And I include unpaid overtime, and I suspect a few of you on the table up there might be included in that. But the second question is, what is the criteria for the success of work-life balance? Because the implication seems to be that the only reasonable criteria is profitability to the company. And first of all, re-regulation in the last 8 years has not led to a reduction in profitability, and it has led to, there has been an increase in employment. But surely we should also be more overt about looking at the social gains that need to be made by employment policy, and in particular, particularly topical at the moment, is pensions and the need for women to have decent pensions. And they can't have decent pensions unless they can combine work and caring responsibilities. And the very final point is that if we're to have a lifelong learning society, there is also an issue here that is not about caring, it's about ability to move in and out of the labour market. And I think those wider issues, they're much harder to look at in a company policy, but they do need to be somehow assessed and weighed up and given a value.
Thank you. I'm going to just ask for some, not necessarily from everybody, unless everybody wants to say something, but you know, quick responses from people. I did have a question for John Dowdy, though, coming out of these two, which is two of the questions here. Which are, is there any research that you know that looks at the age profile of workforce? Because I do think that was an interesting point about how that might change. You know, we know that companies like B&Q are now becoming famous for employing older workers. Or does anyone else know of any research of the impact of having?
I know we can talk about what we learned about age in our own work, which was that, in fact, at the beginning it looked like the age of the average employee in a firm did affect productivity, interestingly enough. But that was a red herring. It was actually the age of the firm that was an indicator of productivity, and that new firms tend to have higher productivity. Why? Because they start with a green field and they can do whatever they want, whether it has to do with work-life balance or the way they lay out the shop floor. And what that said is new business formation is an important driver of overall productivity growth. But I don't know, I'm fairly certain that we haven't done anything looking at employee age and work-life balance in our work. And I don't know if any of you know whether there are other pieces that have done that. I don't know.
If you had any things that you were dying to respond to from the other questions, I know that there was also this question of whether the individual is hurt by any of these measures. I guess that also gets back to the cost question of imposing regulation.
I just wanted to say two very quick things, actually, in conclusion. One was that I find the point about firms that are looking at older workers absolutely fascinating, because I think it illustrates that work-life balance is a learning curve, and we are understanding more about it, because those very sectors that are now looking at older workers for flexibility are the ones that led the way in the 80s, looking at women and maternity returners. So it is interesting that they're the ones who've got there first. And the other was just to challenge this notion that work-life balance is somehow done better or is done more in large firms. I think absolutely the large firms have got the checklists. But actually, when you look at small and medium-sized companies, and as I said, as I think I said when I was talking, put aside the things that cost money, they probably won't have the suite of concierge services, etc., etc. But if they're doing it well, they will have good managers who understand how people work and how flexibility works, and put the two together and create an organisation that works.
John?
Well, I'm going to say is that thank you all for the questions. Read the report, and we're also having a reception on the fifth floor afterwards with drinks and snacks, which you're all invited for, and you're welcome to pummel me and my co-authors with further questions, should you so desire.
Thank you very much for coming.